Ohio, the Greater Cleveland Food Bank planned to distribute 12,000 meals, a 5,000 meal increase from a year ago. We are now seeing families who had an emergency fund, but it's gone, and they are at the end of the rope. Christine Warzoka, president of the Greater Cleveland Food Bank, told The Guardian. We are going to be doing this for a really long time, and that's frankly terrifying, given the impact hunger has on physical health, learning, and development for children and parents' stress. In Texas' second largest city, the San Antonio Food Bank distributes 8 semi-trucks full of food every day, but it still was forced to resort to rationing due to soaring need. COVID-19 has taken so much, people's jobs, their loved ones, and now we're just trying to stop it from taking Thanksgiving, San Antonio Food Bank CEO Eric Cooper told CNBC. Pre-pandemic, we were feeding around 60,000 people a week, and now we are seeing around 120,000, and most of those are new to the food bank. They've never had to ask for help before, he added. Indeed, among the thousands of cars that lined up starting in the pre-dawn hours for free Thanksgiving meals at Houston and RG Stadium last weekend, there were more than a few luxury makes. I was just telling my mom, you'll look at people pulling up in Mercedes and stuff, come on. Randy Young, a recently laid-off cook at the stadium who was waiting in line with his elderly mother, told the Post. If a person driving a Mercedes is in need of food, you know it's bad. It's been hard to survive, Young said. Money's low, no jobs, hard to find work. London County, Virginia is per capita the wealthiest county in the nation, with a median household income of just under $140,000. Yet the Post reports, London Hunger Relief recently handed out meals to 887 households in one recent week, a 300% increase from pre-pandemic activity. We are continuing to see people who have never used services before, Jennifer Montgomery, London Hunger Relief Executive Director, told the Post. In the U.S. largest city, Food Bank for NYC President Leslie Gordon told France 24 that even before the pandemic, there were 1.5 million residents here across the five bureaus who didn't always know where their next meal was coming from or what it would be, and that's escalated considerably to nearly 2 million of the neighbors. Across the U.S., demand has not let up, and food banks do everything they can to make sure families have food on the table for Thanksgiving, Zoani Villarreal, a spokesperson for Feeding America, told The Guardian. There is no end in sight, but we can't be the only solution. Celia Call, CEO of Feeding Texas, stressed to the Post that without sustained aid at the federal level, we will be hard-pressed to keep up with demand. We're just bracing for the worst, she added. Several progressive lawmakers tweeted the Post article over the past 2 days. One of them, Representative Rokana, said that Congress has the power to address this crisis and asked, why aren't we doing it?
European News Bulletin.
Hi there, this is News Bulletin. My name is Amina Taylor, and we're broadcasting from London. We start now as more details begin to emerge into the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsin Fakhrizadeh. Leading security official Ali Shakhkani has revealed no individuals were present at the site of the attack. Rather, remotely controlled electronic devices were used in the assassination.
The operation was very complicated and was carried out by using electronic devices. No individual was present at the site. We have found clues and the person who designed the operation is known to us. We know who they are and what their background is. Definitely the MEK hypocrites had a role also. Definitely the criminal element of this action is the Zionist regime and Mossad.
Other reports suggest a remotely controlled car with a concealed machine gun and a self-destruct mechanism were used to carry out the operation. Israel has claimed previous attacks that killed three other nuclear scientists, but has declined to comment thus far. Iran's defense minister has vowed to continue the work of the scientists with, quote, more speed and more resilience. John White, the author and political commentator, is with us from Edinburgh. And John, the use of unmanned technology in this way suggests a rather large-scale operation. Your thoughts?
Good evening. Yes, a highly sophisticated operation, perhaps the most sophisticated we've ever seen of this kind, involving electronic equipment operated via satellite, we've been told, clearly carried out by a state, clearly carried out by the Israeli state and its notorious intelligence agency, Mossad, or a subunit within Mossad, and with the participation of the MEK terrorist organization in Iran. The great worry for the Iranians will be the extent to which security arrangements surrounding two of its most important officials have been breached this year, leading to their assassination. First, Qasem Soleimani in January, and now Mr. Fakhrizadeh just the other day. That's going to be a great worry, and it goes without saying that there will be a comprehensive review taking place of those security arrangements within Iran as we speak. But this operation has far-reaching consequences for geopolitical relations between Iran and the West. The fact that there's been no condemnation of any serious kind from any Western government is proof positive that the Israeli exceptionalism continues to be a bane in the region and in the wider world. Where are the economic sanctions? Where is the expulsion of ambassadors? Any of the measures that would be levelled at Iran if the Iranian security had carried out the assassination of Israeli scientists in Israel, for example?
You mentioned right there the silence on this issue to an extent, because there have been murmurings coming out of Brussels and, of course, London. But this idea that there should be restraint as we wait to find out what happened on almost a both sides of the argument issue here, where does that leave you, John?
Well, it's hypocritical in the extreme. Words of condemnation are one thing, but fine words butter no parsnips. As I just said, we need to see sanctions. We need to see the expulsion of ambassadors. We need to see Israel held to account for its repeated criminal actions. And the fact that it keeps getting away with this only encourages it to undertake more criminal actions of this kind. It's a violation of international law, human rights. It was murder, foul murder, carried out in violation of any code of ethics worthy of the name. And I'm very concerned that nobody from the incoming Biden administration has voiced any criticism of this action. John Brennan, the former head of the CIA, rightly described it as reckless and criminal, but we need to hear this from an incoming Biden administration with reset of relations with Iran surrounding its nuclear program in mind. If that doesn't happen, it's going to be very difficult for a Biden administration to have any credibility and to be trusted by the Iranian government with regard to its adherence to any such diplomatic efforts that it may try to undertake to get JCPOA back on track.
And very briefly here, John, does this act of terror constitute provocation?
It's a massive provocation, and it's designed to be one. And it does place the Iranian government in the invidious position of choosing whether to undertake immediate retaliation, which is entirely justified in doing, or to play the longer game, knowing that this could well be, as Mr. Rouhani rightly points out, a trap being set by the Israelis and by the Trump administration before it departs the stage.
Wise counsel, as always. Thank you very much, John White. Now we move on to some other news here coming out of Germany, because at least two people have been killed and many more injured when a car plowed into civilians in the pedestrian area of the German city Trier earlier today. Eyewitness testimonies captured by local news outlets just moments after the crash have reportedly stated that passers-by flooded into nearby shops as the speeding car drove into crowds of people. Some have also claimed to have seen a pram being flung into the sky and seeing at least 30 people laying motionless on the streets. According to police, the suspect, a 51-year-old driver who resides within the Trier district, has been arrested, and the large vehicle he was driving has been seized pending further investigations. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has voiced growing security concerns over China's global rise at a meeting of the military alliance's foreign ministers.
China is not our adversary. Its rise presents an important opportunity for our economies and trade. We need to engage with China on issues such as arms control and climate change. But there are also important challenges to our security.
The comments will not have gone unnoticed in Beijing and would be seen as a continuation of the increasingly confrontational rhetoric the West has taken in regards to China. This following similar statements from the Trump administration and its European allies. As the UK prepares to exit its second national COVID-19 lockdown, all hopes seem to be pinned on a vaccine to ward off another and perhaps bring life back to some semblance of normality. As the COVID-19 death toll rises to more than 1.4 million annual across the globe, governments are fast-tracking the approval of various vaccines, and millions of doses are on the verge of being shipped across the planet. However, one of the challenges of mass immunization is convincing people the vaccine is safe, and the speed with which these ones are hitting the shelves could be a source of concern, as Bianca Rahimi reports.
Despite working at breakneck speed, the makers of the COVID-19 vaccines now on the verge of being rolled out insist no corners have been cut. Biotech company Moderna has applied for US and European emergency authorization for its vaccine, which it claims to be 94.1% effective with no serious safety concerns. Meanwhile, United Airlines are getting ready to kickstart a global supply and distribution network for Pfizer's vaccine. Governments everywhere are trying to secure their share to kickstart their economies.
We have every reason now to be very hopeful that these vaccines really will turn the tide in the struggle against the disease and unlock not just this country, but unlock the whole of the world and give people finally a sense of relief.
And as we set out this weekend, we've secured 2 million further doses, meaning that we in the UK now have access to a total of 357 million doses of 7 different vaccines.
A mass inoculation program is expected to begin in late December, and more than 80% need to be vaccinated for the global initiative to succeed.
The challenges of mass distribution are immense. Some of those challenges are convincing people that the vaccine is necessary and safe, because this has happened before and things have gone wrong.
In 2009, a British company developed a swine flu vaccine. It was approved by the European Medicines Agency for use across the EU, but following a widespread vaccination campaign, 1,800 people, primarily children and young adults under 30, developed debilitating narcolepsy that causes excessive and often uncontrollable drowsiness. So is this happening too fast?
Apparently the MHRA, the Medicines and Health Regulatory Authority in this country, has put out a tender, which was put out through the EU. I think that's how it got picked up into the news. But this tender is for an artificial intelligence system, which they are saying is necessary to spend public money on that because there are going to be a very high level of adverse events. Now, we obviously have had vaccination in this country for a very long time, mass vaccination programs on a routine basis. So that's quite surprising because we've got all of these other vaccines with a system which copes with their adverse events. But apparently now we need an entire new standalone system because the level of adverse events expected are going to be kind of off the scale of what our existing systems can handle.
Children will not be immunised, but the British government has not ruled out making the vaccines compulsory for adults. Westminster is mulling ways to incentivise getting the jab first. People may need an immunity passport or QR code on their phone to attend football matches, the theatre and other events like the Tokyo Olympics. Qantas Airlines have already announced that proof that you've been vaccinated will be compulsory on its flights. Bianca Rahimi, London.
With big differences still to be bridged on state aid and fishing, Britain and the European Union have warned each other that time is running out to reach a Brexit trade deal. The United Kingdom will completely sever ties with the European Union on the 31st of December, when a transition period of informal membership ends. This comes as massive divergences on fisheries and trade disputes still persist. Speaking on the EU-UK Brexit tensions, German Chancellor Angela Merkel has stated that many EU member nations were, quote, losing patience. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who's also tackling the worst official European COVID-19 death toll, has previously stated that a deal would be preferable for Britain, but the UK would be prepared for a no-deal Brexit in any event. Well, Jonathan Fryer, the author and commentator, is with us for this one. And Jonathan, will we get a deal? It seems this week is as late as we can push things.
Well, despite the rather fraught nature of the stop-start negotiations in the last few days, I'm actually feeling a little more confident that there will be a deal after all. Opposition parties in Parliament have started debate or discussing whether they're going to vote for it or against it or abstain, even though they don't have a text in front of them. And both sides in the talks have said they're prepared to talk right through this week, into the weekend, even beyond if necessary, because they really do want to try and find a deal. But that doesn't mean they necessarily will be able to overcome all of the outstanding issues.
Well, we've had Prime Minister Boris Johnson speaking before about, you know, it being okay without a deal. Chancellor Angela Merkel is now saying that some EU leaders are losing patience. Is Britain going to just continue holding its bluff, holding its line clear here?
Well, I think the frustration felt by the EU 27 leaders is very understandable, because whereas Michel Barnier, the EU negotiator, has carried out his side of the bargain in a very civilized, calm manner, the British side has been really quite aggressive, including from the Prime Minister, and have accused the Europeans of being the obstacle in the way of a deal, which is frankly not an objective appraisal of the current situation. And let's face it, the EU27 don't want Brexit. They never did. And several of the member countries, not least Ireland, are really going to suffer economically if indeed it goes ahead, and especially if it's a no-deal Brexit.
Well, I'm not asking you to be a betting man here, Jonathan, but what do you say are the chances of a no-deal at this stage, and where would that leave the Conservative Party going forward?
Well, I think it's probably now about 50-50, which is better than a couple of weeks ago. But as far as the Conservative Party is concerned, they will probably get a hit in the opinion polls early next year. But we have to remember they've got a majority of 80 in Parliament, so pretty safe. And they don't have to have another general election for another 4 years if they want. So Boris Johnson has time to ride this out, though rumours have it that he actually would quite like to step down early in the new year and hand the poison chalice over to somebody else.
Well, perhaps he can hold counsel with David Cameron and how that left his political career. Jonathan, thank you so very much. To some other news now, because as you might recall, over the summer, huge Black Lives Matter protests were held across the United States and all over the world in solidarity with Black Americans who are facing racial injustice. But in those subsequent months, have the words Black Lives Matter come to mean something entirely different? Well, this is the question Richard Sedan is asking in this edition of Cut to the Chase.
Over the summer of 2020, Black Lives Matter protests erupted over the US and around the world following the death of George Floyd. Anti-black racism and police violence in the US had restarted a new wave of protests, which first started in 2015 in Ferguson, following the killing of 18-year-old Mike Brown, a black man, by a white police officer, Darren Wilson. Fast forward to 2020, and this time millions upon millions around the world marched in solidarity with black Americans, causing the whole world to side-eye America. This global attention became concerning to the powers that be, and so the slogan Black Lives Matter began to be attacked to divert focus away from why the protest began, which is racial injustice in America, which has existed as long as the country has.
Black Lives Matter is now more popular than the President of the United States.
Black Lives Matter is killing Americans.
So what do I think those riots are? I think the depravity. I think they're thugs.
Right-wing media began intentionally using the term Black Lives Matter without distinguishing between those at the protests and Black Lives Matter, the organization. With no distinction made, criticisms of Black Lives Matter, the organization, de facto became attacks on all black people in much the same way as the phrases thug, calls for law and order, gang culture had become the codified language of the white media to describe black people without doing it directly, reinforcing racist stereotypes already deeply rooted in America. This linguistic trick of European colonialism isn't just found in America. We see these subtle forms of racism in the UK media too, with phrases like knife crime, gang culture, and so-called black-on-black crime routinely peddled by the racist press. Using the term Black Lives Matter to simply mean black people is another tactic. Next came the claim that George Soros, rather than the continual killing of black people in America, was somehow the sole cause of the Black Lives Matter protests. While Soros contributed money to Black Lives Matter, the organization, neither the organization nor Soros are behind the millions of people rallying for justice for black people. Again, the sole cause is systemic racial injustice and police killings, something white America and the media wants you to forget. Remember, the police in America were literally formed from slave-catching gangs and still exist to this day to maintain the racial hierarchy in America. The precedent of giving white people like Soros the credit for things done by black people is not a new trick. White people are given the credit for ending slavery, apparently discovering Africa and America, where black people had already traveled to, while telling us that aliens built the pyramids and that Jesus looked like Brad Pitt. Trust me when I say this, George Soros isn't responsible for the protests in the United States. Also not responsible for the Black Lives Matter protests are so-called trained Marxists. While the founders of the Black Lives Matter organization in the US might identify as such, only a tiny minority of the many millions around the world who identify with the slogan Black Lives Matter are Marxist. All of these excuses are commonplace in the news. What you will never hear is the very blunt reality and cause of the protests. Ongoing continued racism in the US, massive levels of lethal violence towards the black community from policing and white terror groups the police often turned a blind eye to. Systemic racism at the heart of the United States, which has existed for more than 400 years, is not a broken system. It's the system working as it was meant and designed to do so. Those who benefit from this system will tell you anything to make you believe black protests are a conspiracy. There is no conspiracy. Systemic racism as a system of power in America is working as it was meant to. Those who benefit from it want to keep it that way. So, the next time you hear someone using the term Black Lives Matter without defining it, you can be sure that they simply mean all black people, and you know what they really mean.
So troubles down under as tensions brew between Australia and China. You can tell me all about it, Robert Indakesh.
Well, if you've been paying attention to the media in recent weeks and around a month ago, we saw a story emerge because of leaked documents out of the Australian military, which pointed out that Australian Special Forces teams had essentially killed 40 Afghan civilians in the most brutal ways you could imagine. But the Australian media is not mad so much about that. The Australian media is mad about the fact that China, in fact, a Chinese diplomat tweeted a cartoon which was created which depicted an Australian soldier killing an Afghan child. This is what the Australian Prime Minister had to say about this.
The Chinese government should be totally ashamed of this post. It diminishes them in the world's eyes. I want to make a couple of points about this. Australia is seeking an apology from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs from the Chinese government for this outrageous post.
So no ability to take any criticism we see there from the Australian side, trying to say that this was a doctored photo when clearly it was a cartoon. Anyone who looks at it can see that it's a cartoon. And this is criticism from a foreign government. And it doesn't seem that the Australian media as well, when we look at the Australian media and the way they've reacted to these two stories, they've went absolutely irate when it comes to this tweet. Which came out just a few days ago. But when it comes to the claims of their soldiers massacring Afghan civilians just for the fun of it, that seemed to be not quite as offensive to them, and they didn't really...
So let me
really
see if I get this right, Rob. It's not so much the claims that Australian troops were committing extrajudicial killings here in perhaps a conflict they have no business being in, but it's the fact that a Chinese diplomat flag this up in a cartoon. Am I missing a link here?
No, that's exactly what's happening here. I mean, even when you look at the case of these Australian soldiers, they've sent them notices, which they have 2 weeks to respond to. I believe 13 of them, these special forces people, were sent these notices. And essentially, they're saying that they'll be fired, but it will take years and years for it to even come to court. They probably will not be imprisoned for their crimes against humanity, which were committed in Afghanistan. No reconsidering of their role in Afghanistan, despite the fact that they've been there for 19 years and there's no reason for them being there. But they're just absolutely irate when it comes to these a depiction, I believe an accurate depiction, of what was happening in Afghanistan. So this is how they deal with foreign criticism. And it's funny that the Chinese said, because there's an ongoing sort of dispute between Australia and China, they said that they'll turn Australia into the white trash of Asia, which seems to be the way that they're reacting here, just thinking that they are the superpower behaving like it and trying to tell the Chinese that they can't criticize Australia when Australia is frequently criticizing China, and China has not behaved in this way.
Right. The online reaction to this should be interesting.
The first tweet we've got here is from Syrian Girl on Twitter. She says, "The image China tweeted about Australia isn't fake or doctored because it's a depiction. They're not saying this is an actual photo. What's actually fake is babies in incubators, children overboard, Syrian chemical weapon attacks. What's real is Australian soldiers shot civilians." We got another one here as well who says, "A reasonable summation of the pic is that it is graphic but accurate in its depiction. We are getting the outrage. The outrage is not because Australians did commit such heinous murders, but because they are being exposed internationally for it."
And this is, very briefly, Robert, a rather new phenomenon. We hadn't really heard much about Australia's behavior and its role in Afghanistan.
No, we hadn't up until this point. We heard quite a bit about British troops and what they'd done. But Australians have killed, and there's various human rights groups which have reported on this, have killed a lot of Afghan civilians, hundreds of them, in collateral damage due to their airstrikes that they've committed.
All right. We'll leave it and obviously continue to watch that story. Robert Inlakesh, thank you. And, of course, thank you for staying with us. Until next time, stay safe.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Scott Atlas has resigned as special advisor to President Donald Trump, a White House official confirmed on Monday, 30th of November, after a controversial 4 months during which he attacked science-based public health measures and clashed repeatedly with other members of the coronavirus task force. "I'm writing to resign from my position as special advisor to the President of the United States," Scott Atlas said in a letter to Donald Trump dated 1st of December, according to Fox News, which first reported his resignation. Scott Atlas later confirmed his resignation in a tweet. Atlas is a neuroradiologist who has no expertise in infectious diseases and has repeatedly and consistently downplayed the threat of the coronavirus. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Julia Carey Wong. The piece is titled, "Scott Atlas Resigns as Trump Pandemic Advisor After Controversial Tenure." Stay with us for more of Julia Carey Wong's article. Scott Atlas has resigned as special advisor to President Donald Trump, a White House official confirmed on Monday, 30th of November, after a controversial 4 months during which he attacked science-based public health measures and clashed repeatedly with other members of the White House coronavirus task force. "I'm writing to resign from my position as special advisor to the President of the United States," Scott Atlas said in a letter to Donald Trump dated 1st of December, according to Fox News Channel, which first reported his resignation. Scott Atlas later confirmed his resignation in a tweet. Atlas is a neuroradiologist and fellow at Stanford University's right-wing Hoover Institution, where he works on healthcare policy. He has no expertise or experience in infectious diseases or epidemiology, yet he was selected by President Donald Trump to advise regarding the pandemic. Atlas joined the White House this summer, where he clashed with top government scientists including Dr. Anthony Fauci and Dr. Deborah Birx, as he resisted stronger efforts to contain the coronavirus pandemic. Scott Atlas attacked public health measures such as wearing face masks, staying at home orders, and social distancing. He called on residents of Michigan to rise up against restrictions put in place by Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, who had been the target of a kidnapping plot leading to calls for his firing. Stanford University neuroradiologist Scott Atlas has repeatedly downplayed the threat of the coronavirus, which has killed more than 265,000 Americans. Atlas also promoted the idea that the U.S. should aim to achieve herd immunity, a so-called strategy that would probably result in millions of deaths, and was repeatedly rebuked by public health experts and infectious disease experts, in addition to Stanford University and the Stanford Faculty Senate. His views also prompted Stanford University to issue a statement distancing itself from the faculty member, saying Scott Atlas has expressed views that are inconsistent with the university's approach in response to the coronavirus pandemic. "We support using face masks, social distancing, and conducting surveillance and diagnostic testing," the university said on 16th of November. Stanford University statement added, "We also believe in the importance of strictly following the guidance of local and state health authorities." Scott Atlas has been sharply criticized by public health experts, including Anthony Fauci, the leading U.S. infectious disease expert, for providing President Donald Trump with misleading or incorrect information on the virus pandemic. He has downplayed the importance of wearing face masks and this month said lockdowns had been an epic failure in stopping the virus's spread. Scott Atlas defended his role in his resignation letter, saying, "I cannot think of a time where safeguarding science and the scientific debate is more urgent." The resignation comes as the country faces a deadly surge in coronavirus infections and record-high hospitalizations. The United States is currently reporting more than 100,000 new coronavirus cases every day. Dr. Celine Grounder, a member of Joe Biden's advisory panel on the coronavirus crisis, greeted the news of Atlas's resignation with relief. Dr. Celine Grounder said, "I'm relieved that in the future, people who are qualified, people who are infectious disease specialists and epidemiologists like myself, will be helping to lead this effort," she told CNBC. "You wouldn't go to a podiatrist for a heart attack, and that was essentially what was happening." Scott Atlas was hired as a special government employee, which limited his service to the U.S. government to 130 days in a calendar year, a deadline he reached this week. Meanwhile, the United States continued to report more than 100,000 new cases of coronavirus every day over the Thanksgiving holiday weekend, as experts warned the widespread Thanksgiving travel could fuel a surge in the coming weeks. In New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo warned of a problem in the hospitals, a serious situation, and appealed for retired physicians and doctors to return to the front lines. The number of new cases reported in the United States topped 200,000 for the first time on Friday, according to Johns Hopkins University. Since January, when the first U.S. infections were reported, more than 13 million cases have been recorded, and more than 265,000 Americans have died. There was some good news on Monday, 30th of November, as Moderna said it would apply for U.S. authorization to use its coronavirus vaccine. The company announced final results from its trial, which it said confirmed 94% efficacy for the vaccine. Moderna's data will be weighed by the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, on 17th of December. The company said it expected to have doses for 10 million people ready for the U.S. by the end of December. Pfizer and BioNTech submitted an application for emergency use on 20th of November. The news came as the number of hospitalizations in the United States reached a record high. According to the COVID Tracking Project, 93,238 patients were in hospital on Sunday, 29th of November, a steady climb from 47,531 at the start of November, straining health workers and resources as winter approaches. In Rhode Island, hospitals reached COVID-19 capacity on Monday, 30th of November, the same day a two-week pause meant to control the rise in new cases took effect. A state alert to phones read, "Hospitals at capacity due to COVID. Help the front line by staying at home as much as possible for the next 2 weeks."
Around the World with Reporters.
Iran, Cuba, and Venezuela host a virtual seminar at the UN headquarters in Vienna on unilateral sanctions and their impacts in light of the COVID-19 pandemic. The three countries are under crippling US sanctions that have added extra pressure as they struggle to fight the coronavirus. banking restrictions resulting from the sanctions are affecting the country's ability to obtain medical equipment, a point highlighted by the UN Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. Iran's ambassador to international organizations in Vienna, Qasem Gharibabadi, said as the world's biggest imposer of unilateral sanctions, the US should be held accountable for the consequences of its actions.
These sanctions violate human rights in the current circumstances. In our country, we also face a problem in importing medicine and medical equipment from abroad as a result of these cruel, unilateral, coercive measures and banking restrictions. Those who impose these sanctions have international responsibilities.
The Cuban ambassador said many countries are unaware of the impact that these sanctions are having on countries' healthcare systems and people's normal day-to-day lives.
As a result of this seminar, we will try to impulse all declaration in all resolution of United Nations to include the request to the United States and the other country and the European country who impose unilateral coercive measure to lifting those measures as the Secretary General of the United Nations requests and the High Commissioner of Human Rights.
In a joint statement, representatives of 38 participating countries said unilateral coercive measures are against international law, human rights and the UN Charter.
Under the current circumstances caused by the coronavirus, they said, sanctions have made targeted countries vulnerable and need to be lifted. Homolezki, Vienna.
We are told that EU officials are monitoring the situation in the Middle East very closely as tensions escalate over the assassination last Friday of senior Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The 27-nation bloc's foreign policy spokesperson, Peter Stano, gave this reaction when we spoke to him via Skype.
What happened on Friday in the city of Abzaz is a criminal act and runs counter to the principle of respect for human rights for which the European Union is standing for.
One EU lawmaker says Israel orchestrated the attack under false pretenses and in cahoots with the Trump administration to try and scupper Joe Biden's plans to re-engage with Iran in 2021.
People should remember that Iran has no nuclear weapons, despite for the last 25 years Israel crying wolf that they could develop one. Israel has nuclear weapons. So, I mean, which is the bigger danger to peace in the region?
Political commentators say the EU has a pattern of issuing strongly worded statements, but will once again shy away from taking any firm steps against Israel. They say the bloc has turned a blind eye to repeated international law violations perpetrated by Israel and Saudi Arabia. Apparently, this is because the EU does not want to upset the United States, but also trade in weapons and goods to these regimes is worth billions of euro annually. The big question now is, how might Tehran respond to Fakhrizadeh's murder? And what impact could any such response have on ambitions under a Biden presidency to save the Iran nuclear deal? Tehran has always insisted its nuclear energy program is purely peaceful. Security analysts say the Israeli regime and the very powerful Israel lobby in Washington have shown time and time again the last thing in the world they want is peace with Iran. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iran has held a funeral ceremony for its top nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was assassinated near Tehran on Friday. Due to coronavirus, only senior government and military officials attended the event. Addressing the participants, Iranian Defense Minister Amir Khatami said assassinating Iranian scientists is an indication of the enemy's defeat. The defense minister vowed a crushing response to the perpetrators of the attack.
Every criminal activity, every assassination or terror will be responded. The enemies must know that they will receive a crushing response and that we will act in accordance with the order of Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei.
Fakhrizadeh, who headed the Iranian Defense Ministry's Organization of Defensive Innovation and Research, was assassinated after his car was ambushed in the city of Absert, east of the capital, Tehran. Fakhrizadeh was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but he succumbed to his wounds. He had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program. This made him the number one target of Israel's intelligence services, which have a track record of targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists nearly a decade ago.
History has shown that the actions of the enemies will not be left unanswered. We will take revenge. We will punish all those who ordered and those who carried out this terrorist attack.
The main perpetrators of these terrorist attacks against my father should wake up to this reality that this path will continue and his blood will make his name remain in history for good. They can do nothing.
Observers say the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program, which Tel Aviv accuses of having military dimensions. Iran has time and again dismissed such allegations and signed the 2015 nuclear deal with the world powers as a sign of goodwill.
Iranian officials have vowed a crushing response to the main perpetrators of the attack against Dr. Fakhrizadeh, saying his path will continue much more resolutely than ever before. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian People was designated by the United Nations on November 29 in 1977. The day is marked every year internationally with rallies and activities aimed at drawing attention to the struggle of the Palestinian people. This year, a protest was held in the village of Khan al-Ahmar that is under a threat again to be demolished by the Israeli military. On this day, Palestinians assured they will continue to defend their lands amid calls by the Palestine Liberation Organization to enable the Palestinians to exercise their right to self-determination and their independent state.
We are still struggling to protect our basic rights against Israeli regime violence. Meanwhile, our dream of an independent Palestinian state has not yet come true. We have come here to voice our protest against Israel's aggression. We are the real owners of these lands.
This year, however, Palestinians say they were left alone struggling the Israeli occupation and its non-stop attempts to annex more lands, mainly after some Arab states have signed normalization deals with Tel Aviv. These ties, Palestinians say, simply undermine efforts for Palestinian state. Palestinian officials stress that what they see as a symbolic international solidarity has failed to give the Palestinian people their rights, while Israel continues to occupy most of the land of historical Palestine.
Israel will not be deterred by statements of condemnation. Israel can be stopped only by popular nonviolent Palestinian struggle and boycott, divestment, sanctions against its system of apartheid. That's what we want to see. BDS, not normalization with occupation.
The UN, meanwhile, has renewed commitment to the Palestinian people. However, its Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has cautioned that the prospects for a viable two-state solution are becoming more distant, mainly with Israel's expansion of illegal settlements, a significant spike in the demolition of Palestinian homes and structures, violence, and continued militant activity. After more than 40 years since the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people was designated by the UN, Palestinian rights remain usurped and the dream of an independent Palestinian state has not yet come true. Ona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Venezuela's judiciary has convicted a group of former oil executives who plotted with the U.S. government against the interests of the South American country Citgo Petroleum Corporation, which is based in the United States. The judicial ruling comes at a time when Caracas is fighting to regain control of Citgo, as the company was illegally confiscated by the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump. Citgo's former executives were found guilty of passing secret information to American authorities in order to inflict damage on Venezuela's oil industry, a misconduct that is regarded as a major crime in Venezuela. In this scenario, officials support the judicial verdict.
Cada uno de nosotros, ¿verdad? Y la
responsabilidad. The judge's decision is aimed at protecting our country's oil industry from U.S.-funded spies like ex-Citgo executives.
On the flip side, the opposition criticizes this legal case.
There is not enough evidence of conspiracy between the former executives and the U.S., so this court ruling is politically motivated.
Nonetheless, experts say the country's judiciary issued the right verdict.
The former executives are the Venezuelans who hold U.S. citizenship. That's a felony itself, in case you are the manager of a Venezuelan company.
Venezuela's judiciary has punished the former oil executives for their complicity with the U.S. Analysts say this is part of Caracas's legal actions to get back Citgo, the oil company that was illegally confiscated by Washington. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
A human tide, rarely seen, flooded in the streets of Paris and all over France in a freedom march against a new security law. The massive protest is held against President Macron's government that is pushing a new bill that restricts the ability to film police. Human rights associations and media are unanimous. This law would allow police brutality to go undiscovered and unpunished.
There's a huge popular opposition against this law. Even the Human Rights Commission of the United Nations and other international bodies criticize it. A social majority in this country refuses the implementation of this law. Since a long time, we alert the government on police brutality and violence against women. Violence against women during the lockdown is exploding, and the government remains inactive and guilty.
Two major events this week plead in favor of the protesters and of the importance of video footage to denounce police violence. First, French police dismantled a migrant camp in central Paris. The French government ordered an internal police investigation after police officers were filmed tossing migrants out of tents and intentionally tripping one while evacuating a protest camp.
It is important to film this kind of situations because it's part of freedom of expression. Filming with our phones is almost the only way of publishing this kind of violence against migrants, people from the suburb, against everybody.
And then a second video showed the violent arrest of a black music producer in Paris. Three police officers repeatedly punched and hit him during 20 minutes. The man told that the officers made racist insults.
Thanks to the images showing the beating by a kind of private militia attacking a music producer, the truth has come out. Without this video footage from a surveillance camera, the man would be in prison accused for using violence against the police. That shows the importance of having a counter power in this country.
Under a huge pressure, Interior Minister Darmanin announced disciplinary proceedings as soon as possible, but that might be too little, too late. In the meantime, the protest is going on.
A large majority in the French parliament voted in favor of the security law, but the Senate still has to approve it. Right-wing senators, a majority in the Senate, declared they will rewrite the law because it is unconstitutional. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
Tens of thousands of Sudanese have bid farewell to their last democratically elected prime minister, who died of COVID-19-related complications at 84. According to the National Umma Party, which led until his death, Sadiq al-Mahdi died in hospital in the United Arab Emirates, where he was receiving treatment after becoming infected with the novel coronavirus in October.
I think the loss of the Sadiq al-Mahdi, the Umma Party leader, and the Sudanese, the most intellectual person in the Sudanese political process, is so great loss. It will be reflecting on all and hold the political process.
You know, Sadiq is the greatest one in the Sudan, and this era need him. Why? Because according to the government,
Al-Mahdi served as a prime minister in the mid-60s and again in the mid-80s before he was overthrown in a coup of 1989, which led to rise power of President Omar al-Bashir. After being forced out of office, Al-Mahdi remained a leading politician in Sudan. In a statement, Sudan Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok described him as one of the most important figures of South politics, literature, and wisdom in the country. Meanwhile, senior National Umma Party said that the party will continue to follow the anti-Israel policies taken by the late Sadiq al-Mahdi.
We have our own doctrine based on the Islamic ethics. We are against the normalization. If the needs arise, not a Burhan, neither Hamdok will decide on behalf of the Sudanese people. The elected, the coming elected parliament will decide on the behalf of the Sudanese nation.
I think this constitution will go in the same road of the leader Sadiq al-Mahdi. In the normalization, against the normalization or any establishment of the relationship between the Sudan and Israel.
Al-Mahdi was a well-known Sudanese political figure who played an important role in public affairs and wrote several books addressing the situation in Sudan.
For more than 60 decades, Sadiq al-Mahdi was an icon of democracy, Islamic thought, and a strong opponent of imperialism in Sudan and abroad. Mohamed Fazari, from Khartoum, Sudan, city of Omdurman.
At 2:30 p.m. local time on Friday, in a countryside area east of Tehran, a truck loaded with explosives blew up to intercept the car carrying top Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Eyewitnesses say five or six gunmen then rushed from a nearby vehicle and opened fire on his car. Fakhrizadeh was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but medics were unable to save his life. The incident immediately sent its shockwaves across Iran and beyond, with Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif calling the attack an act of terror and linking it to Israel. Inside Iran, the assassination comes as a shock. Less than 24 hours after the incident, people from all walks of life gathered outside the Iranian parliament to condemn the assassination, which they view as grave as the U.S.'s assassination of top IRGC commander Qasem Soleimani in January.
What happened to our nuclear scientist was carried out by the same terrorists who killed Qasem Soleimani. Like Mr. Soleimani, Fakhrizadeh offered many services to our nation.
If we back down on this terrorist act, the U.S. and Israel will become more insolent towards us. We have gathered here to urge the government and lawmakers to take a tough stance towards the perpetrators to avoid further such incidents.
Fakhrizadeh served as the head of the Research and Innovation Organization of the Defense Ministry. Iranian officials say he had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote Iran's nuclear energy program.
Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
This had made him the number one target of Israel's intelligence services, which have a track record of targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists nearly a decade ago.
Israel is not willing to see Iran's advancement in science and technology. It killed four other Iranian nuclear scientists, and now it assassinated Mr. Fakhrizadeh. But Israel should know that it cannot stop Iran's peaceful nuclear program, because those martyrs have trained numerous young scientists who will take the lead in this field.
Observers say the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt Iran's nuclear energy program, which Tel Aviv accuses of having military dimensions. Iran has time and again dismissed such allegations and signed the 2015 nuclear deal with the world powers as a sign of goodwill.
Fakhrizadeh now becomes the fifth Iranian nuclear scientist who was eliminated in a terror attack. While all indications attest to an Israeli involvement, Iranians here demand that the government take a harsh revenge. This, they say, would reduce the chances of more Iranian scientists becoming an easy target for terrorists. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
After the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019, all electoral processes in the region were suspended and Kashmir came under the direct control of New Delhi. Also, the role of major pro-India political parties in Kashmir was belittled after New Delhi detained all pro-India politicians. The absence of people's political participation created